This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 30, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. On Capitol Hill, the Enron investigation continues. Colin Powell and 10 other Asian nations about to sign an anti-terrorism pact. And the Nation of Islam leader returns from a 10-nation tour to the Middle East and Africa, where he lobbied against US plans to attack Iraq. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was asked why the United States seems so convinced of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's weapons arsenal buildup and committed to the leader's removal when there are so many other countries that are closer to U.S. concerns.
The policy of the government of the United States has been to regime change for Iraq. That's the Congress and the executive branch both. It has not been that for some other countries, and I guess life's just untidy.
Yet former United Nations Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter says there is no evidence to support the U.S. charge that Iraq has violated the U.N. mandate.
All Rumsfeld is acknowledging is his absolute ignorance as to what the threat is in Iraq. What I'm saying is we can't substantiate this. I mean, that's the equivalent of me coming up and saying, you know, you're a murderer, so I'm going to kick down your door and arrest you. Well, I can't make this charge unless I have something of substance there. It doesn't mean that you're not a murderer, but I have to make a case about it. You know, if we're saying Iraq has these weapons, we must make a case.
And the United Nations is denying reports that it found evidence of a U.S. cover-up of a bombing that killed Afghan civilians. Susan Wood reports from the U.N.
A spokesperson for the U.N. mission in Afghanistan said today that an internal report following a fatal U.S. air raid on a wedding party earlier this month was a humanitarian assessment, not an investigation. The spokesperson said the report contained judgments that were insufficiently substantiated and that a comprehensive report now being finalized would give a more detailed and accurate picture. The London Times reported on Monday that according to the U.N. report, U.S. forces arrived on the scene just after the airstrikes and removed vital evidence, including shrapnel, bullets, and blood. Also according to the Times, the U.N. report found no corroboration of U.S. claims that the aircraft were fired on from the ground. The bombing raid, which killed 48 people and wounded 117 others, is the subject of a joint U.S.-Afghan investigation. But U.N. sources told the Times U.S. investigators are dragging their feet, hoping the issue will go away. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The head of the Federal Communications Commission proposed a massive debt write-off for the telecom business at a Senate hearing today dedicated to analyzing financial abuses by their corporate executives. Gareth Schweitzer reports from the Capitol.
An outspoken proponent of media deregulation and consolidation, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Michael Powell has been forced to turn his attention to the failing telecommunications market. The FCC, which also oversees the telecom sector, has witnessed the industry shed $2 trillion in stock wealth and hundreds of thousands of jobs already this year. Powell announced today that a massive debt write-off totaling $1 trillion would be crucial to maintaining service around the country, and then added that more consolidation, which he calls restructuring, was the path to stability.
For other industry participants, survival and health will depend on some prudent restructuring.
Due to both unused capacity and increased competition for long distance from the baby bells, these companies were unable to sustain profits. Some industry analysts now agree that further consolidation could aid the industry giants, but further hurt consumers who have benefited from increased competition in the long-distance market. On Capitol Hill, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
U.S. Embassy officials in Jakarta faced more than 1,000 angry workers yesterday. The workers say Reebok, the world's second-largest athletic shoe manufacturer, has cut orders, leaving about 5,400 Indonesians jobless. Reebok says they cut orders to three factories, including the one in Indonesia, and claims it was due to falling quality. At the protest, workers set fire to a large replica of a Reebok shoe and chanted, "Reebok are killers. Reebok are exploiters." The Associated Press reports that many U.S. manufacturers are shifting their work to Vietnam and China, since the 1998 fall of Indonesia's dictator of 30 years, General Suharto. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In a ceremony involving members of Congress, the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the new so-called Financial Crimes SWAT team, President Bush today signed legislation to restore investor confidence in American corporations. The new corporate accountability package increases the penalties for security fraud. Vice President Cheney's old company, Halliburton, is under investigation for securities fraud, allegedly perpetrated during Cheney's tenure as CEO. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, senators continue to investigate the collapse of Enron. Senators charge Merrill Lynch with helping Enron make itself look better financially than it actually was. But critics of American corporate culture charge that most of the giants in the financial community were complicit in Enron's ill-fated schemes. Joshua Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
The transaction most scrutinized today was a 1999 deal whereby Merrill Lynch allegedly pretended to buy from Enron three diesel-fired power generators housed on barges offshore of Nigeria. Merrill Lynch got a 15% return on its $7 million payment for the barges. Senate Governmental Affairs Investigations Subcommittee Chairman Senator Carl Levin says it wasn't a sale at all, but an illegal loan intended to keep Enron's stock price high.
Merrill Lynch knew it, Enron knew it, and yet Enron booked $12 million in income from the proposed sale, or supposed sale, and that was a deception in its financial statement, and Merrill Lynch was a participant in that deception.
Enron, of course, would go on to declare what was at the time the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Merrill Lynch employees closest to the Nigeria barge deal pled the Fifth Amendment protection from self-incrimination today and were dismissed. The subcommittee heard instead from a Merrill Lynch employee not directly involved in the transaction, Senior Vice President Kelly Martin.
Never at any one point in time would we do something that we thought would be wrong. But there'd be no way that we could possibly know with a $40 billion company all the various transactions that they were doing.
Well, let me tell you.
While today's Enron hearing implicated Merrill Lynch, last week Citigroup and Chase Manhattan were on the Hill facing allegations of securities fraud. Editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, Russell Mokhiber, says a recent study showed 47 of 50 of the top brokerage firms were recommending investors buy or hold stock in companies they knew were doomed to bankruptcy in the first quarter of 2002.
So, for example, Lehman Brothers maintained 6 buy ratings on failing companies. Solomon Smith Barney maintained 8 hold ratings right up through the date the companies filed for bankruptcy. Why are all these brokerage firms telling small investors to buy these shares or to hold these shares, knowing that they're failing? They're doing it because they're conflicted, because they're making millions of dollars by doing business with the same companies that they're raiding.
Mokhiber says the corporate accountability legislation the president signed today is a smokescreen for real corporate reform, that Washington is too dominated by corporate campaign contributions to fix the conflicts of interest that are destroying pension plans and keeping investors out of the stock market. One sidebar to the saga of Enron's Nigerian barges is that they were paid for in part with $200 million U.S. taxpayer dollars last July through the government's Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC. Here's Jim Vallette with the Institute for Policy Studies.
The World Bank was also involved in Enron's power play in Nigeria. They last year approved $100 million towards the privatization of the power sector in Nigeria. So that's just one example of many of the union that was forged between government agencies and Enron, as well as operators like Merrill Lynch, in playing this globalization game that benefited what turned out to be a very handful number of people.
Vallette says he hopes that over the course of the continuing Senate investigations into Enron, U.S. taxpayers will learn more about the role international financial institutions played in the company's ascension. But Vallette says it's already clear the U.S. government bent to Enron's will and that some major players in the financial sector stood to benefit. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
Secretary of State Colin Powell and foreign ministers from 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, wound up a two-day meeting in Brunei today, vowing to pool efforts to fight terrorism. Powell and the 10 foreign ministers are to sign a declaration tomorrow promising to cooperate in anti-terrorist campaigns, share information, block terrorist funds, tighten borders, and make it tougher to use forged travel papers. In a region that has a large Muslim population, this is not the first time the U.S. has attempted to go into Southeast Asia. But today's pact represents the first real collective action involving 10 Asian nations and the United States. Some Asian leaders have raised concerns about the war on terror, attacking basic rights of their citizens. But Colin Powell says the war against terrorism does anything but.
We did discuss human rights in each meeting, and in the context of our counterterrorism efforts, I made the point to all of my interlocutors that we still believe strongly in human rights and that everything we do has to be consistent with universal standards of human rights.
Powell held talks in Malaysia yesterday with Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad and stopped over later in the day in Singapore. Malaysia, Singapore and the Philippines have so far worked the closest with the U.S., leading efforts in the region to combat what the U.S. calls terrorism. The U.S. has clearly stated its fear that certain Asian countries might become hotbeds for Islamic militancy, hence the need for the anti-terror pact with ASEAN. Lisa Lagoza Maza, a member of the Philippines House of Representatives, says that the U.S. has been using the Philippines to strategically advance its access to other Asian countries.
The reason for the U.S. presence now, which they are saying that it is because they are after this bandit group, Abu Sayyaf, is just a cover for the U.S. agenda to reestablish its permanent presence in the Philippines, in the Asia-Pacific region. Right now, they are negotiating for a mutual logistics support arrangement, which will allow for the construction of storage facilities in our country.
These storage facilities in the Philippines, she says, are for oil, a very different agenda to the military operation the U.S. has been running. And today, about 2,000 demonstrators slammed the U.S.-led anti-terror exercise in the Philippines ahead of Powell's visit later this week. In the capital, Manila, a dozen protesters waded through chest-deep waters adjacent to the U.S. Embassy building and waved signs reading, "Powell, you're not welcome here," and "Goodbye, Joe, don't come back." Today's protests occurred as tomorrow, the six-month counter-terrorism exercise between U.S. troops and Filipino soldiers in the southern Philippines is set to end. However, as Lagoza Maza points out, while the U.S. military may be leaving for now, today's anti-terror pact ensures U.S. presence in the region continues.
We know that the Philippines is a very important place for the United States strategically in terms of its economic and political agenda in the region. Also, it is near China, which is a huge market for America. And it is near Japan, which is its rival capitalist country.
And in signing this pact with the 10 Asian nations to cooperate in anti-terrorist campaigns, share information, block terrorist funds, and tighten borders, among many other provisions, the U.S. is ensuring its grip on countries with vast natural resources tightens. Asad Isni, a Pakistani journalist specializing in U.S. foreign policy to the Third World, says that none of the 10 signatory Asian nations really had a choice in signing the anti-terror pact.
They are going through the motions of saying whatever the U.S. wants them to say, because if they don't, they'll be severely punished through trade measures, through economic measures, through the World Bank and the IMF, which the U.S. controls, and through in many other ways.
Powell is to make an overnight visit to Manila later this week, and then he heads to Indonesia Thursday, a country the U.S. sees as crucial to their plans for controlling Muslim terrorists. With Colin Powell in Southeast Asia attempting to rope in the region to a U.S.-led anti-terrorism pact, one country that the U.S. itself has inflicted much damage on is Vietnam. The damage to Vietnam's environment during the war was so extreme it gave rise to the term ecocide. Vietnam's forests are crucial to its economy and social structure, providing food, fuel, materials, and habitat for animals. Vietnamese scientists and foresters have made impressive progress reforesting certain areas of the country, but lack the resources to apply what they've learnt to the remaining areas. Patrick Beckett has more.
The Vietnam War caused unprecedented damage to the environments of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Over a 30-year period, the U.S. military sprayed some 72 million liters of defoliants to destroy vegetation. It employed 14 million metric tons of bombs, twice the amount used in World War II and the equivalent of 328 Hiroshima atomic bombs. It also used land-clearing tractors known as Rome plows to clear 325,000 hectares of forests. Dr. Vo Quy is with the Center for Natural Resources and Environmental Studies at Vietnam National University in Hanoi. He began studying the damage to Vietnam's ecosystem during the war after observing the widespread destruction of forests by defoliants.
During the war, the U.S. Army sprayed a lot of herbicide on the land of Vietnam, the most on the tropical forest. About 2 million hectares of tropical forest of our country destroyed by herbicide. But about half of this area completely destroyed. And not only the trees, not only the forest, but the animal, the fauna of this area is killed as well.
Some reports estimate that 25% of Vietnam's southern forests were destroyed. Many of the areas grew back with a tough grass unsuitable even for grazing, known in the region as American grass. Despite the U.S.-led embargo, which crippled the country's resources for more than 20 years after the war, the country has created extensive tree plantations. But Vietnam's naturally diverse environment makes restoring the ecosystems especially challenging. Again, Dr. Quy.
It takes a lot of labor, money to regrow, but not easy because we try to find some good species. And we, our scientists, we have to make a research because we cannot plant any kind of plants in any place in our country because our country is very different. The condition is different. And the scientists have to make research what kind of trees we can plant in this area.
One of the most delicate ecosystems in Vietnam are its mangroves, which grow in tidal zones of coastal areas and inland swamps. Chemical defoliation during the war destroyed more than 40% of coastal mangroves. Lê Đức Thuân is from the management board of the Can Gio Mangrove Biosphere Project. He describes some of the functions mangroves have on the ecosystem.
It has many functions to prevent from the erosion, flooding, and from the storm. Mm. And mangrove is a good habitat for aquatic animal. Mangrove provided a lot of food for humans.
Lê Đức Thuân has helped restore almost 40,000 hectares of mangroves in the area near Ho Chi Minh City, but he says there are 400,000 hectares that need restoring. Restoration of Vietnam's forests are one of many challenges still facing that country 3 decades after the end of the war. Modern warfare technology and strategy continue to impose comparable damage throughout the world. In 1970, Barry Weisberg wrote the book Ecocide in Vietnam and is director of the Violence Prevention Peace Promotion Strategy Project.
Vietnam was the opening chapter in an intensive process by governments, both against other governments and against their own landscapes and people, to devastate the environment and the ecological systems. The burning of oil fields in Kuwait, the bombing of dams in Kosovo and Yugoslavia by NATO, the use probably of depleted uranium in Yugoslavia. There are a number of examples.
Patrick Beckett in Stockholm for Free Speech Radio News.
Senior U.S. military officials, as high as members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have told media in recent days that they have deep unease about American plans to invade Iraq, believing they are ill thought out with the strategy to achieve the ultimate objective of toppling Saddam Hussein far from clear. And today, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein called U.S. and British claims that Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction, quote, a joke. Meanwhile, the Nation of Islam has launched a petition drive to defend the First Amendment rights of leader Louis Farrakhan in the wake of his 10-nation tour to the Middle East and Africa. A major purpose of that trip, according to Farrakhan, was to encourage the unity of Muslim leaders so they could speak with one voice against U.S. plans to attack Iraq. Nick Alexander has more from East Oakland.
Keith Muhammad, the youthful 38-year-old minister of Nation of Islam Temple 26B in East Oakland, read excerpts from the Hands Off Farrakhan petition.
Knowing that the government of the United States of America is not beyond bringing charges against those that have stood up for our freedom, we are asking everyone to support us in a campaign to respect and protect the free speech rights of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and we have a petition drive. Knowing that the American government has a history of waging wars, domestic and foreign, and for improper and unjustifiable profit, gain, enrichment, and revenge of the elitist capitalists wealthy of these United States at the expense and to the detriment of the black, the brown, the red, the yellow, and the poor white citizenry.
The petition begins in part, quote, "We, the undersigned citizens and taxpayers, affix our signatures to advise, warn, and admonish the U.S. government that it will not arrest, harass, or otherwise interfere with the divine and lawful rights of the Honorable Louis Farrakhan for going on a peace mission to save the lives of black, brown, red, yellow, and poor white United States citizens," unquote. Farrakhan is no stranger to attempted government prosecution. When Farrakhan returned from an 11-nation tour in June 1986, then United States Attorney General Edwin Meese called for his arrest for traveling to Libya in violation of President Reagan's executive order forbidding U.S. citizens from visiting this so-called terrorist state. The threat of prosecution was widely seen as motivated by Farrakhan's outspoken support for and collaboration with Libya's Muammar Gaddafi in a time of escalating conflict between the U.S. and Libya, making the defiant minister a matter of, quote, national security. The Nation of Islam in turn moved to prevent an arrest by filing suit against Reagan for violation of Farrakhan's rights under the First Amendment to freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and the right to travel. In the post-9/11 era, Nation of Islam fears of being victims of a government campaign have resurfaced. Nation of Islam members cite the Logan Act. It is a 200-year-old congressional law which restricts private individuals from conducting foreign policy. Republican Congressional Representative Peter King of New York cited the Logan Act when he called on the U.S. government to revoke Farrakhan's passport after the minister's 1996 tour of Africa and the Middle East that included visits to Libya, Iran, and Iraq. Keith Muhammad says the petition drive is a preemptive move to defend the Nation of Islam leader.
Well, first, as American citizens, according to the written law, we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But as I have read and have come to know just from the study of history, certainly when those rights were written, they had no idea that black people would ever be recipients of the above said rights. And so now that Minister Farrakhan, as a descendant of a people who had been robbed of the ability to exercise those rights, begins to actually exercise those rights, we discover that America has a problem with dissenting voices in her midst.
Meanwhile, in a press statement delivered in Baghdad, Farrakhan said his delegation stood against, quote, murder and war. He said if the American people really understood and knew the horrors of UN sanctions against Iraq, they would rise up against such a policy and demand the lifting of sanctions, coming on top of the effects of the 1991 Gulf War. Keith Muhammad.
So in the name of taking a shot at Saddam Hussein and trying to get his people to overthrow him, the American government has sanctioned a policy or has instituted a policy that is killing 5,000 people per month. 1.6 million have died since the war was over as a result of the sanctions coupled with the depleted uranium that have been left by the most massive bombing in the history of the world.
Keith Muhammad is Minister of Nation of Islam Temple 26B in Oakland. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nick Alexander.
A Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up today at a central Jerusalem fast food stand, wounding 7 Israelis. The food stand was known to be popular with Israeli police. A Sharon spokesman said that Israeli plans to ease restrictions on Palestinians would be delayed if attacks continued. The violence occurred as Palestinians in Nablus defied the Israeli-imposed army curfew for the third day in a row today, restoring a semblance of normal life in the city after more than a month of military occupation. And as Palestinians in the Gaza Strip continue to mourn their losses from last week's Israeli attack that killed 15 people, our correspondent Kata Mester spoke with the family of some of the victims.
Surrounded by some 20 members of his extended family, Rami Matar spoke from his hospital bed in Gaza City, where he is recovering from a severe head injury.
I was at my home when the incident took place. I remember it was after 12. Suddenly I heard a big explosion, saw a bright light in the sky, and I didn't remember anything after that. I woke up here in the hospital around 11 the following morning.
For 2 days, Rami Matar did not know the Israeli military dropped a one-ton bomb in his middle-class residential neighborhood, Daraj, in Gaza City, killing 17 Palestinians, mostly children, and injuring some 140 others. Palestinians living in Karakaji Street say they did not know Salah Shahada moved into the neighborhood 3 weeks earlier. Over the weekend, Rami was released from the hospital. He still does not know that 6 of his family members died in the attack, among them his 2-month-old daughter, Dina. With her broken arm in a cast, Hana Ahandi Matar, Dina's mother, sits across the street from the remains of her house, surrounded by neighbors and relatives.
We have no money. We have no house. We have no children. Dina died. Dina, 2 months, died. She's a victim. She's an innocent. She's an innocent. She's died. What does she do for Sharon and for the other world? She wants to live in peace. God take her to live in peace and leave us to live in war and suffering.
1 week after the attack, many injured Palestinians, some with badly damaged houses, wonder how they will recover. The bomb, which obliterated a 3-story building, rained down cinder blocks, glass, and iron reinforcement rods onto neighboring houses, punching holes into walls and ceilings. Ismail Abu Rahman Abdu and his family of 11 live behind the bomb site. Abdu, who worked as a builder until the beginning of the Intifada, walked through his home surveying the gaping holes and new cracks in the walls, floors, and ceiling.
It is difficult to live in this house after the Israeli strike. Even the walls are polluted by gases from the explosion. I believe the whole house is wrecked, and I doubt how safe it is for my family to live here. Even engineers and building experts cannot grasp the extent of the damages, but they do believe that it is not a safe place for living.
Many Palestinians like Abdu have been unemployed since the beginning of the Intifada and have no resources to repair the damages caused by the Israeli assassination of Salah Shahada. Abdu and others in the neighborhood say they will continue to live in their damaged homes, some with blown-out walls and roofs, because they have nowhere else to go. A man who only wanted to be identified by his first name, Jihad, said he owned one of the destroyed buildings.
So far, there is no one who has expressed or is willing to reconstruct this area to help the people who have suffered great losses.
1 week later, Karakaji Street is covered in a film of concrete dust and is still littered with mattress stuffings, remnants of school notebooks, and rubble. No one here knows when or if any reconstruction will take place. To date, no country has demanded any reparations. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza City, I'm Kata Mester.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.